as I get closer to where he went off the road, I see a big black shape in the middle of the road walking. So I have to slam on my brakes and try to swerve myself because this thing is walking in the center of the road. Because I don't see a head and I don't see arms. I just see a really big, tall person, like big, thick legs and a big, thick torso. And they're moving very funny.
But to be honest, I wish I had have seen some of her vulnerability. I wish I'd have seen her in that space so that I would have language.
And he says, no. That's not why you're angry. That's why you're mad. Mad is on the surface. Mad is a surface emotion. You're angry. And anger is deep. That cuts to your soul. You are an angry young man. And I couldn't answer. I then had come to realize over the next course of a few hours, I'm musing to myself, and I realize I've been a victim my whole life. That's why I'm so angry. And over the course of the next 19 months, this man changed my life. He helped me to realize about processing emotion and how to forgive myself and forgive others. And that's where the metamorphosis really began for me. And I learned how to, I'm a survivor, right? I know how to survive.
I was understood for the first time in my entire life. And when I read those things and I learned, quote unquote, those things about myself that I had known forever, but never really had the semantics for, I couldn't unlearn them. Like I heard this quote years ago and it resonated with me so much. And it's like, you can choose to look the other way, but you can never again say you didn't know.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Verbal Echo Podcast. Thanks for hanging with me while I took a little bit of a break, but I've got some great guests coming up and we're back at it. So my guest today is Jacques Smith. He grew up in South Africa, and as an adult, he lived in Asia and Europe working as a game developer before settling with his family in Wellington, New Zealand. While working as a production manager for Pickpock, he became a master transformational coach and now supports leaders in creating effective teams. Jacques writes fantasy fiction laced with positive psychology, and he has a new book out called The Eye of Winter. So we're going to jump into it, and I want to introduce my next guest, Jacques Smith. Okay, today I have Jacques Smith on, and he's an author. He's got a new book out. Welcome, Jacques.
Hi, Monica. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I love interviewing authors. So you have a new book out. It's called The Eye of Winter. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah, the short version is it's a reverse heist. So the thief is going to stop other thieves from stealing the thing rather than stealing the thing themselves. And then because I love positive psychology and I'm a master transformative coach myself, I decided that, you know, usually you take these protagonists. In fact, as an author, I kind of see my job as putting the protagonists through the worst time of their life. And I thought it would just be fair to then also provide them some sort of like psychological support to put them not just physically back together, but actually psychologically back together. Because so often, like the journeys that these protagonists go through, would a normal person would be left either an emotional wreck or a sociopath. And neither of those make for a wonderful heroic character in the future. So, you know, in terms of positive psychology.
Yeah. So how did you get into positive psychology? Through coaching? I noticed that you're an ICF coach. So did you study positive psychology in PERMA, or how did you run into that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So yeah, I was first exposed to it when I was doing my initial coach training. And the deeper I went into my coaching journey, I went up to like master transformational coaching. I'm a PCC coach, professional certified coach with the ICF, just did my submission for the NCC recently, which I feel great about, but that's by the by. But as I was exploring this, I got really interested in positive psychology because I discovered that it was kind of like the underlying structure of what we were doing as coaches. And I went and researched a lot about more understanding for what Martin Seligman came up with his team and, you know, kind of like where does it all come from? Why did this, you know, suddenly get discovered when he initially discovered it back when they were looking at the dogs and the experiment with the electricity on their feet, and some like learned the behavior of not even trying to escape the pain, and some actually, even though they were now no longer able to escape it, were still actively trying to get away from it. And that really triggered like a curiosity in me to learn more. And I went and learned about Angela Duckworth, and because my games development background, I've always known about flow and Csikszentmihalyi. That's basically what we try to do in games, is we're trying to create flow state. So kind of like opening up that door and realizing, oh, that's actually positive psychology. I know a bit about this. And then I went and I did some courses on it as well. I didn't do any degree on it, but spent probably at least a degree's worth of reading on it, and then did some courses on it. And yeah, everything I found was awesome. I incorporated it into my coaching practice. PERMA scores like is a thing that I continuously track whenever I'm working with someone to make sure that they're actually getting value, that their well-being is improving. And also trying to think about, like, you know, gain frame, loss frame. When someone is stuck in a loss frame where they just see what they don't have rather than what they do have, how that affects your mind. And that I found was a really interesting thing for narrative and storytelling, is like often the conflict lies in the loss frame. You know, the engagement, the tension lies in the loss frame. And I think it's also why we can sometimes get a bit caught into that as human beings. It's much more fun to sit with your friends and talk about all the things that are wrong. It's not always that fun to talk about the things that are right. And so trying to actually find ways to both bring the gain frame, what we're going to get from this, not just what we're going to lose from it. And how can we make that an interesting story? How do we create tension? How do we create engagement in the story, but actually have this thread of positivity and possibility, future possibility? So yeah, anyway, that's a long answer to your question, but yeah.
That was a great answer.
I'm excited about it.
Yeah, no, that was a great answer to my question. I love talking about PERMA and positive psychology because I'm a coach too, and I understand what you mean about going to, probably could have gotten a degree with all the reading. I just kept reading book after book after book. And after you, I noticed when you were talking about that, and I thought, oh, flow, gaming, that makes sense. So you kind of piece that together. That's really interesting. And tell me about, so in your some of your information, you talk about Dungeons and Dragons and how that was an influence on your writing. And I was wondering, if did you work with some of that? Did you use some of those tools when you went and you worked for game publishing, or how did that affect you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So all of these pieces, like fantasy and Dungeons and Dragons, weren't by chance. Like there was a little bit of chance in there, but there was also kind of like a thread going on there as well. Some recent studies have come out that actually shows that Dungeons and Dragons is an effective treatment for depression, anxiety, loneliness, and stress. And that there are some therapists that actually incorporate it into their treatment. There are also other studies that have shown that there's some validity to the idea that fantasy or science fiction can be like a mini holiday from stress. This escapism idea that people can actually deal better with things like that because they can, at least this is my interpretation of it, is like when you step into that space, it's almost like I can look at deeper, more kind of heavy topics because I'm looking at them from a bit of a distance. This isn't the real world. I'm not going to be under some illusion that this is my real life and what's happening to me. Like I'm looking at someone else in another world that is completely different from me, and exploring their experiences in a unique and interesting way. And often because it's science fiction and fantasy, we can push these things to the nth degree. We can really push them to their max to see how does it stretch? And I think these are reasons why it became a platform for me to explore positive psychology and wanted to see if I could, to put it this way, like cut the veggies into the meatloaf kind of thing, right? Like there's some real cool things here for you, but don't worry about them. There's a nice story that's going to kind of take the sting off. You don't have to worry about it, this being some nonfiction thing where you're going to have to push through some, you know, lots of experiments being explained. Though I do have that at the back of the book where I, you know, kind of mention the techniques I'm using. Dungeons and Dragons for me is like, and fantasy in general, has been a kind of stress management that I did for myself, self-medication, to be honest, be a kind of like blunt with it, from when I was in college days. So I first got introduced to it by a bunch of friends when I was studying graphic design. And as I started playing with them, I was completely like taken by this idea of being able to create anything. Like anything is possible. You can create beautiful worlds and new species and stories. And because I've always loved games, it allowed me to kind of bring that, to put it this way, it's the difference between watching a movie and reading a book. Yes, the movie is an amazing experience, but it only engages your visual, your audio, auditory senses. And that it has to like kind of create emotion through that. A book can touch other senses. It can touch your smell. It can touch your taste. It can touch your interception, like how you feel inside of yourself. And Dungeons and Dragons can do the same thing compared to video games. Like video games, you know, really immersive, really cool stuff. But if it lives inside of your head the way that it does in Dungeons and Dragons, like it does with reading a book, it just feels so much more engaging and so much more fantastical. And what I did was, because I played lots of Dungeons and Dragons, I always ended up being game master, the person who basically like I tell the story and everyone else tells their story within the world that I'm creating. I started to develop game development and game design skills, which I then combined with my writing skills to get my first game development job. But the idea that I used to create the book and the world, yeah, you can see the map. The audience won't be able to. Yeah, it's right up there.
I'm looking at it. It's so cool. I was going to ask you about that because I think I read on one of your web pages about that you started with a map. And I thought, oh, I wonder if that's the map. That's so cool.
Yeah, that's right. That is the map. And the players actually shaped that map. There's a whole section that's like completely black on one side where one of my campaigns, the players ended up spreading a plague through that area and destroying the whole countryside. And I had to redraw the map to reflect that. And it's cool little elements like that that brings the world to life. And it's like the fiction that I write isn't about the campaigns that other people played, but the campaigns that other people, characters that other people created, live in this world and shape the world and can be interacted with the characters. And it just gives it a little bit more texture that's not just my mind, but, you know, collective mind being brought together a little bit as well. I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, I think that's really interesting. I do interview quite a few authors, and I'm always fascinated with the story of how they came through the creative process. And it's always so unique and personal. And I think writing is such a great platform to express yourself. It's truly, you know, your voice. And it's never just, oh, I'm going to sit down and write a book today. You know, there's always a path that made you get to the point where I have to write this book. It's almost like a pouring out of information or experiences or knowledge. And you just got it. Most writers just get to that point where they're like, I just have to get this down. I don't care. I just have to start getting this down. It's just, it's fascinating to hear that process, the creative process, I guess. Yeah. And I think it also ties into what you were saying about flow, because that's definitely part of flow is writing. Yeah. It's so cool.
100%.
Go ahead.
No, I think that's a really good point. And people often talk about writer's block as a challenge that they face. And I find that often that's the stages where in flow, you're kind of like dropping into the anxiety zone. You've taken on a new challenge that's beyond your skill level, drops you into the anxiety zone. And you can, there are lots of different reasons for why people have writer's block, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but one particular case is like where you're just faced with a scenario you haven't dealt with before. And so you don't have that perfect balance between challenge and ability. And you kind of have to push through that and spend some time in the anxiety zone and just allow it to forge you a new skill so that it can return you back into that, you know, that good zone where you just feel like your time is warping and you're disappearing into your work. For me, that was editing. When I first went through the editing process, I love writing, but sitting there and having to like nitpick literal like letters and words, that was not for me. But through hours and hours and hours of doing it, eventually I got good enough at it that I was like, okay, actually, you know what? I can disappear into this work too. But if I had given up, I wouldn't have gotten to that stage.
Yeah, editing's hard. So I do quite a bit of writing and I go back through and I'm like, oh, that sounds so bad. Thank goodness for apps like Grammarly and Hemingway, and there's a lot of them out there, but it's definitely a good tool to use because, yeah. So what I ask this question a lot with writers, what advice can you give about what you learned through the publishing process?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think when it comes to publishing, the writing is the easy bit, right? Like it's the editing and then the publishing that really requires you to learn new skills and push yourself beyond what you were, just the creative sitting in a corner having, you know, making something new. That's the fun part. That's the easy part. And I think being open to that new experience, and even if you're going with the traditional publishing route, accepting that no one is going to promote you for you. It's on you. You want people to read your book. You're going to have to put yourself out there and connect with people and, you know, find ways of helping them see why they should invest their time. Because reading is a big investment. You know, someone today picking up your book, it can be, you know, it's 11 hours to read my book for someone who reads fast. That's a huge investment. And I want to make sure that someone who picks it up and it goes for it has a good understanding for why they should and how they should. So when you're thinking about the publishing process, think about what is your sellability? What is it that makes your book unique and different? Why should people read what you have to bring to the table? And think about it from the customer perspective, not from your writer's perspective. You're speaking to a person that has a need. And if you understand the need, it's easier for you to address it than if you are saying, well, I wrote this book because I wanted to write a book. Cool. That's great. But why should I buy it? Why should I invest in that? And then, you know, there's just a lots of bits and pieces that you're going to have to get used to your data, like, you know, kind of understand what it looks like when you've got sales on and how people are going to respond and how do you counter that, you know, capitalize on that. How can you attend events? Where will your customers be? Where will your ideal readers be? For me, that's, you know, any event that has lots of comics and dragons and games, for you, that might be something different. But yeah, it's, if you find your audience, you understand your audience and you know where to be to find them, it's going to be much easier for you to be able to connect with them and for you to be able to make a case why they should give your book a try.
I think you're saying get out there and do some in real life things.
Exactly.
Yeah. Not just, hey, it's on Amazon. Great. There's so many things on Amazon. But your book seems really unique in that you've kind of found your audience. You kind of wrote to your audience. And so you're able to get out there and like talk to people and go to, I'm assuming like conferences and little public things. And so you can get out there. You also got a really nice website. I looked at it. It's very well done. So good example. Definitely.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's really well. I was going to ask you about your challenges that you might have had when you struggled to first start writing, and you mentioned ADHD, and so was wondering if you could touch on that and how you overcame it and, you know, how you handled that challenge.
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think that's also something that's pretty close to my heart. Lots of people these days are discovering that they have ADHD, or, you know, especially in my industry. I think the company that I work with recently did a study where they looked at all the people and tried to understand how they were doing in terms of their neurodivergence. And something like 40% of the company actually were neurodivergent, and ADHD was a large percentage of that. It's also a big part of why I love positive psychology and why I love Dungeons and Dragons, because, you know, ADHD is this ability to essentially be in the open-minded, broadly associative thinking space a lot. And people respond really poorly to you being in that space when they actually want you to get stuff done. And so that swings you into like an anxiety space where you, you know, kind of like narrow-minded and closed-minded. And I've seen in my own life how that cycle can do a lot of damage to your personal relationships, to the way that you engage in your work, the challenges of being a school kid and going through that sort of thing. And, you know, for me, it was the 90s, which didn't understand how to work with this really well either. And, you know, the self-esteem impact that that can have as well, because everyone keeps telling you, hey, you're really smart, you should be doing well at school. And you're like, well, I just am not doing well at school, and everything I try isn't working. And when I tried to write in 2009, my first attempt at like going for it, I finished the book and I looked at it afterwards and I was like, you know what? I can see that this is quite derivative. I haven't read enough books to have kind of like reference in my head for being unique and different and being my own thing. So I just ended up writing a lot of other people's work all together in one place. And so I needed to kind of like go on a journey where I extended myself, started reading a lot and exposing myself to more stories. But with ADHD, it was really hard to sit down and read a book. Audiobooks were also less available at the time. It wasn't like I could just type it Audible on and read the book alongside, which these days is a really great way of doing that. And the other option was to go medication. But at the time, that was also not really in my mind. I'm not even sure why. I don't think I even considered it until maybe 4 years ago. And so I went on this journey where I kind of like went up and down, really trying hard to read more, learn storytelling. It got me into the game space. I made games with companies, started having all kinds of challenges around interpersonal things, because when I was on my game, I was amazing. But then I would hit one of these like kind of anxiety spills where I would be just a nightmare to work with. And that set me on the coaching journey to learn more about coaching, because like, well, I need to have some tool set with which I can improve my communication skills. And as I then kind of unpacked positive psychology, became more self-aware, I started seeing a coach on a regular basis, like, you know, weekly. I learned all these tools to be able to essentially like direct my own focus, to be able to hyper-engage, which is another part of ADHD that often is the part that people are less aware of. But when my hyper-focus really engages on a topic, I can rapidly learn it and get really good at it very quickly, much faster than most other people can. The problem for my family is, of course, that while I'm in that state, they struggle to pull me out of whatever it is that I'm doing, which is also not good. And I have to balance that as well on the other side. But when I started to learn how to channel that, which was like 10 years after you know, my initial attempt, I did think about medicating. You know, I was seriously thinking, like, should I go on Ritalin? Should I, you know, try to deal with things that way? And I had already gotten to the stage where I actually became kind of addicted to my hyperfocus. I liked my hyperfocus. I didn't want that to go away. And I knew that if I went on medication, the average would get better and it might be a lot easier for me to focus on things, but the hyperfocus would be a lot harder to engage in, like normal people. And so I decided to stay not normal. And instead, I use coaching to direct my hyperfocus wherever I need to be. And I started reading a ton. I couldn't sleep unless I read. So I had to read every night before bed. Went through hundreds of books and then, you know, started writing things kind of like from scratch 2 years ago. I was like, okay, I'm ready. I've been working on the story, been thinking on the world, developing the world, working on the characters. It's time for me to sit down and do the thing. And I did it. 6 months later, book was done. Editing process took a year and a half, which is, you know, editing process. And then publishing. And here I am, 2 weeks out, and people seem to be responding well to the book, and I can't be happier with the result.
And you just released it, I think it was April 8th, so it's just out?
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. And I had to laugh when you said normal, and then my question to myself is, what is normal anyway? I don't think that really exists.
I agree. I think normal is overrated.
Normal is a moving target. And I think we set ourselves up for frustration when we try to be normal, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Are you going to try to release your book onto an Audible format or an audio download?
Yes. I've been discussing it with my publisher, and we're thinking... I'm going to do the voice myself, which is quite exciting. And like, I'm going to have to do that justice. I want to be a good reader. So yeah, I'm going to do it for sure. Probably take another 6 months or so to get it out. But yeah.
Love definitely. It. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's so cool to use your own voice. I just finished an Audible book on a drive that I had, and it was narrated by the author. When I found that out, I went, oh, this is why it makes so much sense, because I could just feel like the love and the emotion that she put into it, because it was her words, you know. It was so cool. So I think, yeah, if you can do that, that's really cool. Kudos for that.
Totally. I think that's a, like you say, it just adds a specialness to it when you can hear the author read their own work, and there's like a passion to it as well. And for the print book, I was allowed to do the cover design myself. You know, I did the interior of the book myself. The publisher gave me quite a lot of leeway. Good old Paul, I appreciate him a lot. But it just felt right to then also do the voice, even though I'm nervous as hell, right? Like,
you won't be nervous after the first 10 pages. Then it'll be like, oh, this is a job. So
yeah, totally.
Yeah, you have a nice voice, so I think it'll be fine. I look forward to that. So I guess my question is, where can people find your book? Is it on Amazon? Or
yep, that's on Amazon. The most bookstores you can order it. It's unlikely to be on the shelves, at least at this point. I am a new author, and like, convincing bookshops to stock it is quite challenging. But if you go in and you order it, they'll have it. I think the Amazon one's a bit nicer. Having seen the two copies like in person, I think the Amazon, the paper is a bit thicker, and the size of it is a bit better. There's also a special edition signed copy that's available on my website, which was made actually intentionally for the New Zealand audience, because I live in New Zealand, and it was sad for me because I have other friends that are authors, and one of them is like published by Penguin Random House. And I was like, hey, can I have your book? And she's like, actually, it won't be coming to New Zealand anytime soon. You can ship it and it'll cost you $80. I was like, ah, that sounds awful. I don't want to do that. But so I was like, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll get special edition made for New Zealand. But because they ended up having like a really nice glossy cover, and the map's all full cover color, it seems a lot of people outside of New Zealand want them as well. So I made a plan to make sure that anybody could get them anywhere in the world. But they are a bit expensive if you're not, you know, in Australia, New Zealand, or I think the US is also pretty okay. But the rest of the world is pretty expensive.
It's print on demand, right? I think that's pretty much how everyone does it now, right? Print on demand, unless you're doing like traditional publishing.
The Amazon version and the one in the bookstore is print on demand, but these ones, the special edition ones, are there's like a limited edition of them, like limited supply.
Okay, very nice. I have to ask you about your cover art, and if anyone's listening, they will have to go to look at it to see what it looks like. That's really interesting. Can you explain what that is? I don't even know what it is. It looks like a like a crystal or something.
Yeah, that's what it is. So it's a bit of a spoiler, because it's like, okay, what are the bad guys after?
The thing. Okay, it's a hint. Okay, but, all right, that's all. Enough said. Read the book. and then is this going to be a series? Or
yeah, that's right. The second book is already with the alpha readers at the moment, so I'm getting my first round of feedback. So the first draft is done, and it's more kind of like, whereas the first one dealt with the idea of becoming part of a team, putting this kind of like selfish, reckless perspective to bed and evolving into purpose-driven and team orientation. The second one deals more with the changeover from post-traumatic stress injury, as the more modern version of that sounds, to post-traumatic growth, because post-traumatic stress and growth sit on a bell curve of how people deal with trauma. And I thought we often hear about people dealing with in literature post-traumatic stress, but there's very few that actually deal with post-traumatic growth. And so my intention is to show the journey, not just to kind of like say, well, yeah, yes, sure, bad things happened, this person is dealing with them, but actually show the potential on the other side of turning that into the gain frame, the well-being side of things, right? Being able to go beyond your injuries and become better than that as a result of what happened, as opposed to a victim of what happened. I've got some psychologists that already like my book a lot that are going to give me some feedback. So I'm hoping to be able to give that quite a bit of more kind of like substance.
Wow, that's so cool. Yeah, congratulations. All right. Well, any other plans in the works? Just the second book and get that out? And
yeah, I think for the books, I'm basically just thinking like, as long as there is an audience and people are enjoying it, I will continue to write the series. And if the audience kind of like gets tired of it, I'll close it down nicely and package it up. And then I'll start another series. But at the moment, people seem to be enjoying it. So I'm quite keen on the ride to see where this goes and how far I can take it as well.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, thank you for sharing that and sharing your story. And please, everyone, go out and get a copy of the book and support our writers. And thanks, Jacques. Thanks so much for coming on, Jacques.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Monica. I really appreciate your time and for being open to having this conversation with me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening today to another great episode. I sure enjoy hearing about these experiences, and I hope you do also. Be sure and like or follow this show by leaving a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have an experience or story you'd like to share, be sure and reach out to verbalecho@gmail.com. See you in the next episode, friends. Have a great week.